Today's show is intended as a follow-up to School Sucks Podcast number 177, Proactive, Authentic, Cooperative Conflict Resolution versus Lose-Lose Parenting. It's a distant follow-up to show 79. Ooh, that was a long time ago, 100 episodes ago. That show was called Youth Bashing, A Generation Ago and Beyond. The article that we'll be discussing is over 10 years old, but its topic is, unfortunately, seemingly timeless. This show, it is also a primer or a preview of some of the themes that will be explored in an upcoming show about a movie. Those themes include violence, sex, and even suicide among young people. And of course, who or what is to blame? Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is the 4th of December. Merry Christmas, right? You know? Before you know it. Anyway, today I'm going to read an article. You have been warned. If you don't care for these types of shows, that's pretty much what is happening today. I will tell you this. This is an article, to the best of my knowledge, that you cannot find online. I did look. So, I was at a used bookstore in Newmarket, New Hampshire. Now I'm just browsing, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this big book on the shelf, textbook-sized book, and it's called Everything You Know Is Wrong. And I said, I wonder if that's true. So I picked it up, and I started flipping through it, and I was so relieved to find that what the author meant is that everything that everybody else knows is wrong. I actually happen to know a lot of the right stuff. Cool, I said to myself in the bookstore as I was looking through the table of contents. And, you know, there's articles by Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein. So a lot of stuff I was familiar with. I was really happy to see that. Hidden History, 9/11, not on the nightly news. I'm just reading some of the headings. And it's broken up into, you know, a series of articles written by different historians. Ooh, Arianna Huffington, what did she write? Drug Companies, Sell Hard, Sell Fast, and Count the Bodies Later by Arianna Huffington. I'm just looking through the table of contents right now. So as you can tell, as you've been able to figure out, I purchased this book and I have it sitting in front of me right here. Now, one of the sections in the book is called Social Distortion. And one of the authors in that section is Mike Mails, old friend of the show, even though I've never met him and he doesn't even know the show exists. But I did read one of his articles called Bashing Youth, Media Myths About Teenagers in School Sucks number 79. The title of that episode was Youth Bashing, A Generation Ago and Beyond. Well, I actually found an expansion and maybe an updated version of that article. It's a little bit difficult to tell when exactly it was written, but maybe you've never heard that show. We have a lot of new listeners. Not everybody goes back and listens to the old shows. You know, maybe they started at the first show. They said, what is this guy doing? Sounds like he's talking into some kind of paper towel roll with a clothespin on his nose. Well, he's on the other side of a door from where the microphone is. I don't know where that changes, so I'm just going to stick with the most recent shows. I totally understand that. But the sound quality around episode 79 is pretty good, so you can go back and listen to that, and I recommend doing that. The story that I want to read today is called Myths About Youth. It's pretty long. I might pause at a few points to add some commentary. I might not need to, but we'll see how it goes. So I hope you find this useful. And Mails is very good about, you know, citations and statistics and really bulking up this presentation with a lot of facts. I'm going to omit any in-text citations just because when you're just reading something without being able to see it, that can compromise the clarity sometimes. So also, here's just a quick bio on Mike Mails from Wikipedia. I should probably try to get him on the show. Is he alive? He is. That's great. Mike Mails, born 1950, is an American sociologist who is senior researcher for the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, San Francisco, and content director for an online information service on youth issues. He earlier taught for 5 years up to 2006 at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where he taught sociology of men and California youth in transition. Mills is best known for his book, Scapegoat Generation, which analyzes statistics to dispel many popular myths about youth in the 1990s. He is popular among youth empowerment organizations and many academics, educators, and young people. And I'll put a link to his bio in the show notes so you can see a full list of everything that Mails has written. But today, we are reading Myths About Youth. Here we go. Interest groups in the news media routinely commodify American youth to the point where it is a shorter task to answer the question, which of today's popularly believed notions about adolescence is not a myth? Now, he does a little Q&A here. This might be confusing. He asks a question and then gives an answer, so bear with me. Are today's teenagers more violent than those in the past? No. Uniquely homicidal? Arguable. More criminal? Less so. More in danger of violent death? Safer than ever. Getting pregnant more? Less, actually. Smoking and drinking more? Less. Abusing more dangerous drugs? Far less. Spreading AIDS faster than adults? Not even nearly. More mentally ill? No. More suicidal? Far from it. Failing in school? No. Warped en masse by media images? Silly. More selfish. Dubious. Miserable, alienated, and rebellious? Adults should be so optimistic. 80 to 90% of youths consistently tell surveyors they're happy, self-confident, and get along with their parents. Today's teens in general are more responsibly behaved than their baby boom parents were as kids, or are as grown-ups today. This doesn't include every individual or subgroup, of course. For example, Columbine High School's Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris may have generated America's largest teen killer body count, unless Charles Manson's youthful creepy crawlies have more 1960s victims buried. Further, there was a sharp and temporary spike in homicidal and gun violence among poorer youth in the early 1990s. Yet the many, many positive trends over the last 25 to 30 years have become taboo topics. The large declines in murders by grade schoolers, down 40% from the 1970s to the 1990s, adolescent girls, down 35%, and middle-class affluent youth, down 45%. The sharp declines in youthful drug abuse deaths, down 80%, and other violent deaths, down 20%, the general decrease in youth arrest, down 20% to 40%, depending on the type, these figures refer to stable, long-term population-adjusted rates. While choosing different base and comparison years would show worse trends for some measures and better ones for others, particularly cynical ones, the results do not demonstrate that today's youth are uniquely at risk. Thus, useful nuanced analysis would explore which teenagers, which behaviors, and which time periods are being evaluated. American institutions and interest groups are well aware of the need to disaggregate teenagers into subgroups, to allow for individual differences, and to investigate multiple alternatives in order to make honest statements. Yet virtually, without exception, special interests choose to publicize only the particular worst-case youths, measures and time periods guaranteed to miscast modern adolescents as the worst generation ever. This isn't science or concern for young people, but transparent institutional self-interest founded in anti-youth biases. How else can we explain why adult America, led by its most august experts such as Cornell psychologist James Garabino, would anoint a dozen youths who conducted school shootings months and thousands of miles apart in the last 5 years as poster boys for an entire 25 million member generation? Depict younger teenagers as more at risk today than any other time in recent decades, as the Carnegie Corporation does, when in fact they are safer than ever. Declare that teenagers display the biggest increases in serious crime, while adult crime rates maintain stable, according to Northeastern University's James Allen Fox and many others. When in fact, teens display stable crime rates, while adult felony rates have skyrocketed. Announce that teenagers will show the biggest increases in HIV infections from the White House Office of National AIDS Policy, when in fact, they show among the slowest. Major institutions from the Heritage Foundation and the Josephson Institute for Ethics to the Carnegie Corporation and Child Trends regularly issue studies on youths with redundant, always alarming claims and remedies that would earn opprobrium if submitted in an undergraduate research methods class. Alarmingly often, facts such as the repeated assertion that 5,000 teens commit suicide every year, 2.5 times the real number, are simply made up. The universal ignoring of measures that dispute the bad and getting worse image of modern youth is not due to a dictatorial censorship, but to the suffocating consensus forged by a convergence of institutional interests. All sides, from those who would harshly punish to those who would reform by programs and education, require a continuing youth crisis to promote varied agendas advocating more prisons, police, after-school programs, nonviolence education, gun control, gun rights, legalized marijuana, zero tolerance for drug use, drug treatment, psychiatric treatment, censorship of objectionable cultural images, etc. No interest would benefit from admitting the massive generation-long declines in youth risks or the socioeconomic bases for serious youth risks. No interest group would benefit from admitting the massive increases in drug abuse, the serious crime, imprisonment, and family disarray among baby boomers. The mainstream parents, voters, and consumers whom politicians and the institutions seek to identify with and attract. Whatever the lobby, two standard myths recycle endlessly. The most common is drastically exaggerating teenage problems to promote the need for interest group solutions. The other involves admitting improvements only for the purpose of claiming credit for them. This commodification of youth issues reflects a modern American indifference towards the well-being of young people. They further reflect America's traditional institutional bias, one that hasn't changed in at least a century, that attributes social problems not to unhealthy social structures and mainstream values, but to the growth, bad behaviors, and lack of control of whatever unpopular demographic group is officially targeted at the time. These institutional biases produce faulty analysis and flawed policy, contributing heavily to America's inability to address its extraordinary high rates of violence, gun casualty, drug abuse, unplanned pregnancy, poverty, and other social ills that set the U.S. apart from peer Western nations. Myth number one, teenagers are more at risk today. American youth do have some real problems. 13 million children and youths live in poverty. 350 are substantiated victims of violent or sexual abuses inflicted by parents and caretakers every year. And parents are a dozen times more at risk of drug abuse than their adolescent children. However, rigid political ground rules dictate that socioeconomics and adult behaviors are off the table. Drugs and violence may be discussed only as teenage issues, and all youths are at risk due to their own misbehaviors. Two major reports, by no means unique, serve as perfect examples. The Carnegie Report. In October 1995, the Carnegie Corporation study on younger adolescents, Great Transitions, is the epitome of modern blue ribbon panel reports. Like the 1987 Risking the Future study of teenage pregnancy, the American Medical Association's 1990 Code Blue report on teenage health, and Child Trends 1993 Running in Place on Families, the Carnegie Report demonstrates the extent to which modern experts accept politically driven ground rules that distort adolescent realities. Carnegie's 135-page report, which claims to address the underlying factors that contribute to problem behaviors, devotes two sentences and one chart to poverty, two sentences to child abuse, and one sentence to parents' drug and alcohol addictions. What do the other 134.5 pages of the report cover? Mostly a breathless roster of adolescent misbehaviors purportedly caused by adolescent attitude and developmental deficiencies in this dangerous modern age. Quoting from the report, "Barely out of childhood, young people ages 10 to 14 are today experiencing more freedom, autonomy, and choice than ever at a time when they still need special nurturing, protection, and guidance. Without the sustained involvement of parents and other adults in the safeguarding of their welfare, young adolescents are at risk of harming themselves and others. Threats to their well-being include AIDS and easy access to lethal weapons and drugs that were all but unknown to their parents and grandparents. The continuing decline of the health status of American adolescents is deeply disturbing. Since 1960, the burden of adolescent illness has shifted from the traditional causes of disease toward the new morbidities associated with health-damaging behaviors such as depression, suicide, alcohol, tobacco, and drug use, sexually transmitted diseases including HIV and AIDS, gun-related homicides. The vulnerability of young adolescents to health and educational risks is far greater than most people are aware of, and the casualties are mounting." These statements show how freely modern experts fabricate complete nonsense about young people. In fact, adolescent health and behavior are improving, not declining. First, the fact that injury and violence have now replaced illness as the leading cause of death for adolescents has been true since the mid-1950s, not just for teens, but also for adults up to the age of 40. It does not mean teenagers suffer rising violent death. Rather, it means that many fewer teens die from infectious disease, such as influenza and tuberculosis, today than in the past. And many fewer teens than adults die from cancer and heart disease. These developments are highly positive, not cause for panic. Second, let us compare risks among 10 to 14-year-olds in 1960 to those in the mid-1990s, the age group and time periods the Carnegie Report chooses. In 1995, there were 2 million more American 10 to 14-year-olds than in 1960, yet the National Center for Health Statistics, in 1995, there were 2 million more American 10 to 14-year-olds than in 1960, yet the National Center for Health Statistics reports that there were 4,000 fewer deaths, including 600 fewer violent deaths, among ages 10 to 14 in 1995 than 1960, a mortality decline of 45%. Further, the biggest decline in violent death among 10 to 14-year-olds were those likely to result from risky behavior, drugs, guns, drownings, falls, hangings, etc., whether ruled suicide or by accident. What might be called society-inflicted deaths, traffic wrecks, plane and crashes, etc., are down, but not as much. This pattern indicates that safer behavior, not just improved standards in medical technology, is a big reason for the death decline. Homicide, a rare fate in this age group, rose, but most murders of 10 to 14-year-olds are inflicted by older teens or adults, often parents, not by peers. In fact, the Department of Justice and State of California cross-tabulations of ages of murder victims and offenders report that 3/4 of all murders of persons under the age of 18 are committed by adults. That's 75%, if you miss the number, of all murders of people under 18 are committed by adults. The crucial point has been almost completely omitted from the public discourse on kids and guns. Further, as discussed later, there are enormous disparities in gun deaths by economic status. White Anglo teens are less at risk than Hispanics over 40, blacks of any age, and white adults up to the age of 45. Thus, while authorities and the media deplore children killing children, the fact is that the two most important factors in the murder of kids are both adult cause: the imposition of high rates of poverty on youth, and the fact that most murderers of children and youths are adults. How about disease? In 1960, students missed an average of 5.3 school days due to illness, disability, or injury. In 1994, 4.5 days. Given the higher proportion of students with disabilities who attend public school today instead of being warehoused as in the past, this improvement is impressive. Death, injury, illness, and disability should just about sum up health status. Even by their own comparison criteria, Carnegie's portrait of grimly declining teenage health is erroneous on every count. Third, lethal drugs and weapons were and are well known to the parents of today's kids. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, when today's parents were that age, around 600 10 to 14-year-olds died from drugs or guns every year, about the same toll as among the same age group in the mid-1990s. Baby boom youths suffered death rates from drugs such as heroin and barbiturates, double to triple that of today's young people. AIDS was unknown in the childhood of today's parents and grandparents, but at least 300,000 in these older generations contracted the disease in adulthood. Fourth, having falsely posed a dangerous world for teens, Carnegie blames youth culture and innate teenage risks. This is quoting again from the report. Today, information conveyed to adolescents comes largely from the media and peers. Much of it is incorrect or misleading, or embodies values that are inimical to young people's self-image and health. Many parents see their teenagers drifting into an amorphous, risky peer milieu, popularly termed the youth culture. Often parents become perplexed, even angry, as they feel their authority weakened and their values challenged. Unquote. In fact, consistent research findings show powerful parallels between the values and behaviors of adolescents and those of their parents and adults around them. One of many examples, the 1999 National Household Survey on Drug Abuse reports powerful correlations between the rates of teenage binge drinking, smoking, and drug use in the corresponding adult rates. However, while ignoring adult influences on youth, Carnegie's experts insinuate adults should blame adolescents for taking up, quote, damaging patterns of behavior, since bad adult health is the result of, quote, a time bomb set in youth. The Center for Adolescent Health report is another. Carnegie's misrepresentations appear in an influential 2001 report by the University of Minnesota Center for Adolescent Health, headed by Robert Bloom. The Bloom study claims that race, income, and family structure together explain only 1% to 2% of teenage risk variation, while individual behaviors, i.e. unsupervised time with peers, account for 20 to 40%. The most astonishing aspects of the Bloom study are how transparently the authors rigged it and that no major institutions protested. When evaluating the effects of race, income, and family structure on teenagers' behaviors, Bloom's study authors employed extremely broad definitions of risk. Drinking one light beer on New Year's Eve was equated with getting drunk several times a week. Having sex with a committed partner at age 17 was equated with doing the football team in sixth grade. By doing, he means having sex with, I assume. Carrying a pocket knife once was equated with shooting multiple victims. One fleeting thought about suicide in a year's time was judged the equivalent to multiple real suicide attempts. Using such broad definitions erases differences between groups. However, when evaluating individual characteristics such as hanging out with peers or difficulty in school, the Bloom study authors switched to a detailed 12-point scale which graded subtle behavior nuances. In this more realistic measure, one drink in a year's time was evaluated as far less risky than habitual drunkenness, and so on. Using detailed scales tends to enhance behavior differences between groups. Then, the Bloom study authors compounded their statistical malpractice by directly comparing social factors, like race and poverty, evaluated by a procedure designed to minimize them with individual factors, like too much free time or school failure, evaluated by a procedure designed to maximize them. This inconsistent method produced the authors' conclusion that poverty and race issues were minimal factors, that concern about them represented backward thinking, and that attention should shift towards preventing individual teenage misbehavior through more controls, programming, and supervision. The Bloom study illustrates how far from real life modern institutional manifestos on adolescents have strayed by design. In Bloom's own state, Minnesota, dwell America's poorest African-American teens and near richest white teens. Compared to white youth, Minnesota black youth are 10 times more likely to have babies, 8 times more likely to die violently, 12 times more likely to die by guns, and 40 times more likely to be murdered. So powerful is the effect of poverty that despite greater access to firearms, as shown in the general social survey, Minnesota white youth, like middle class and affluent American youth elsewhere, have low homicide and gun fatality rates similar to those of Canadian youth. Poverty and race, which is largely a surrogate for poverty, are correlated with 50% to 80% of these risk outcomes, not the 1% to 2% the Bloom study predicts. Would Bloom and colleagues seriously contend that the biggest reason for these staggering disparities is that black kids have too much free time? Myth number two, youth violence is epidemic. Consider the further universal claim that youth today are more violent and are violent at younger ages than youth of prior decades. It is true that among the poorest segment of the teenage population, homicide arrests and deaths rose sharply in the late 1980s and early 1990s, a period in which adult murder was dropping. Beyond that, little stated on the topic of youth violence is accurate. Several states keep consistent statistics over time for murder arrests by race and ethnicity, and these figures track homicide death trends in all states. They show the subgroups containing the vast majority of youth, suburban, rural, middle class, affluent, and all females, experienced no increases or declines in murder. The youth homicide increase occurred only among a small segment of black, Hispanic, Asian, and poorer white youth mostly involved in gang warfare. What caused this increase? The common explanations invoke combinations of natural teenage savagery, media violence, drug abuse, family breakup, gun availability, and gang battles. In fact, the chief trigger was the explosion of hard drug demand in the 1980s and 1990s, fueled by skyrocketing numbers of middle-aged, mostly suburban addicts.
As drug abuse, hospital treatments, and deaths quadrupled among aging baby boomers, gang wars erupted among drug suppliers in inner cities plagued by high rates of poverty and unemployment. These resulted in temporary spikes in gun homicide and violence among young men at the street level of drug distribution networks. As differences sorted out, homicide declined among inner-city males in the late 1990s to levels below those of the 1970s. The contribution of each race to the increase of murders by youthful offenders in the above seven states from the trough in 1985 to the peak in 1991. 4% increase was by whites, 47% by Hispanics, 42% by blacks, 47% by Asians, and other non-whites. Almost perfectly parallels the estimates of gang membership by race. This does not mean that all youthful homicides are due to gangs, but the increase in the late 1980s and the decline in the mid-1990s were due to changes in gang killings. Beyond the vastly oversimplified youth gun violence epidemic, two 1990s manifestations in the commodification of youth violence are egregious. The first is the, quote, adolescent super predator, a creation of widely quoted authorities such as UCLA's James Q. Wilson, Princeton's John DeLulio, Northeastern's James Allen Fox, and former Education Secretary William Bennett. The super predator, in DeLulio's description, was a new fatherless, jobless, and godless black or Hispanic gangster rogue whose vicious marauding would expand beyond the traditional inner cities to menace suburban adults, creating an unprecedented crime storm, to use Fox's phrase. When examined, the super predator menace turned out to be a figment of crude statistical manipulations. The chief assertion by super predator claimants echoed widely in professional forums and in the media is that while overall crime rates are dropping, youth crime rates, especially for crimes of violence, are soaring, as DeLulio claimed. This statement compares two incomparable measures. The National Crime Victimization Survey, which polls a representative sample of families about criminal victimization annually, and the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, which reports arrests for violent offenses reported by police agencies. If the victimization survey is cited, violence is down among all ages. If the FBI is cited, violent arrests are up among all ages. Part of the reason the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention reports is that police are making arrests for domestic violence and street offenses that were ignored in the past. Further complicating the problem is that the age of the offender is not known because only a small minority of violent offenses result in arrest. FBI crime clearance reports indicate that adults commit more crimes per offender than youth do. Fearsome forecasts of the coming storm of super predators were equally vacuous. DeLulio simply multiplied the increase in America's general male youth population aged 0 to 17 from 1995 to 2005, which was 5 million, by the 6% assumed in a 1948 study to engage in multiple offending to produce an estimate, this was DeLulio's estimate, of 300,000 new juvenile super predators who will, quote, murder, rape, rob, assault, burglarize, deal deadly drugs, and get high as long as their youthful energies hold out, unquote. When it was pointed out by UC Berkeley criminologist Frank Zimring that a large majority of DeLulio's super predators would consist of toddlers and grade schoolers, and most would commit shoplifting and minor thefts rather than godless massacres, DeLulio reduced his projection to 30,000, again from 300,000. 30,000 new thugs, even super ones, would hardly be noticed in a nation in which 12 million serious violent and property crimes are reported every year, in which 1 million more middle-aged adults aged 30 to 49 are arrested for violent, property, and drug felony offenses in 1996 than in 1980. The latter trend was completely ignored by all authorities, including Fox, who insisted that mature over 30 adults could not possibly commit such serious crime. Fox, continuing his history of flatly wrong 1970s and 1980s crime predictions based on over-reliance on demographic trends, drew a straight line from the low point of juvenile homicide, 1995, through 1994 and extended the trend to project a tripling in youth killers by 2005. Within 2 years of issuance, Fox's murder forecast was 250% too high. Contradicting Fox's and DeLulio's ever-upward prediction, homicide among black and Hispanic teenagers dropped by 65% from 1993 to 1999, as it had after previous spikes in 1974 and 1980. In 2000, the OJJDP, which again is the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, chastised the youth crime alarmist for their fool's errand and failure to mention the far more serious middle-aged super predators. The dramatic decline in inner-city gang killing in the late 1990s led to the evolution of the super predator theory. Now it was not the dark-skinned downtowner, but the white teenage stone killer who menaced the suburbs. Spectacular cases of brutal killings by upscale, icy-eyed white youths graced the major media, from People and Rolling Stone to nightly news magazines, culminating in massive coverage of the school shootings of 1997 onward. The suburban killer concept proved much more attractive to centrist and liberal interests, whose refutation to DeLulio's and Fox's racialized ghetto and barrio super predator held that all teenagers everywhere were latent savages. If liberals thought such tactics, given the affluent white nature of the new menace, would head off draconian crackdowns and promote humane approaches, the result was the opposite. The irony was that while the super predator scare was attached to a real trend, as noted, gun murders and other violent crime temporarily doubled among black and Hispanic youths from the mid-1980s to the early 1990s, the suburban killer furor contradicted clear trends. The seven states that kept long-term crime statistics by race and ethnicity, California, New York, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Oregon, and Washington, all showed substantial increases in murder by black and Hispanic. And where more detailed data were available, poorer white youth in the early 1990s, combined with very low rates and no increase among non-Hispanic white youth. But by the late 1990s, states such as California and New York were reporting murder levels by Anglo-white teens at their lowest levels since statistics were first kept, 30% below the rates of the 1970s. Thus, the school shootings and other killings by suburban and rural white youth in the late 1990s weren't manifestations of a rising violence trend, but were rare anomalies amid generally declining violence. The only long-term survey of school violence, the Institute for Social Research's Monitoring the Future, reported both black and white youth in 1999 were safer from violence and weapons at school than at any other time since the survey commenced in 1976. Even the supposedly new phenomenon of white school shootings was found to be an old one. Long-forgotten school mass shootings by white high schoolers occurred in the 1980s and the 1970s. 12 shot by a student in rural New York High School in 1974, 9 shot in San Diego Elementary School by a teen in 1979, for example, and perhaps earlier. The 1990s commodification of youth violence has devolved from propaganda to outright falsification. The motley pushers of the suburban mayhem image, such as psychologist James Garbarino and David Eklund, the Josephson Institute of Ethics, the Heritage Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, and a host of authorities, obliterated responsible analysis altogether. The new line, through the latest 2000 reports and commentaries, is that the, quote, epidemic of lethal youth violence has spread throughout American society, unquote, according to Garbarino. In fact, the opposite is true. Violence has become more concentrated. In the late 1990s, just 10% of California's inhabited zip codes accounted for 4/5 of its teenage gun toll and 90% of its teenage gun homicide. Occasional admissions that crime is diminishing and that the schools are quite safe from serious violence are quickly dismissed by the non sequitur that violence, quote, nowadays can happen anywhere, anytime. Myth number 3, messages and policies determine teen sex. In terms of reducing rates of pregnancy and HIV infection among American teenagers that far exceed rates in Europe or Canada, does it matter whether schools teach students comprehensive sex and contraception education or abstinence only? Not much. The evaluations that exist, mainly by ETR associates and academic researchers, indicate that the effects, if any, of sex education, abstinence education, and teen pregnancy prevention programs are small. The virulent sex education debate is another example of the way youth are commodified to serve conservative and liberal ideology. Two factors, poverty and adult sexual behavior, can be used to create a formula that predicts rates of teenage birth, abortion, and miscarriage, that is, pregnancy, to within 10% of the true total. Ever since statistics were first compiled decades ago, and in every locale, trends in and rates of teenage birth, abortion, and miscarriage almost exactly parallel corresponding rates of adults around them. Not much room for all of those other messages that preoccupy the left-right debate over teen sex today, such as TV and movie sex, comprehensive sex education or its lack, youthful ignorance, modern morality, or parents not talking to their kids. Part of the adult teen statistical correlation stems from the fact that a large majority of what we call teen pregnancy involves adult partners. For example, California's comprehensive age of parent figures show a 23-year-old is more likely to father a baby with a junior high mother, age 15 or younger, than is a junior high boy. The Center for Disease Control's HIV and AIDS surveillance and STD surveillance show rates of infection among teenage girls from heterosexual relations are 3 times higher for gonorrhea and syphilis and 9 times higher for HIV than corresponding rates among teenage boys would predict. This indicates that a large majority of sexual outcomes, such as pregnancy and disease, among teenage girls results from sex with men age 20 and older. These patterns, in turn, indicate teenage boys and girls are not sexual peers in the sense the media and programs depict. After a brief flurry of angry attention in the mid-1990s surrounding the welfare reform debate, the fact that most teenage sexual outcomes could better be termed adult teen has largely been forgotten. As with many other impolitic realities, youths face, this one did not suit political or program needs. Nor does the overriding issue of socioeconomics. Where American teenagers enjoy low rates of poverty common among European teens, American teens show the low rates of pregnancy and HIV rates found among European teens. For example, California's most affluent counties contain 500,000 white teenagers. Their annual birth rate, 3 per 1,000 females ages 10 to 17, is similar to those of Sweden or Germany. A few hours drive away, black, Hispanic, and Asian youth in the state's poorest migrant labor counties have birth rates exceeding 50 per 1,000 families, similar to Ethiopia or Bangladesh. Race is not the factor. White teen birth rates vary fivefold from richer to poorer counties, as do birth rates for other races. Whether major teen pregnancy lobbies acknowledge poverty as a factor at all, they imply that middle-class and affluent teens have similar pregnancy rates as poor youth, but were more likely to obtain abortions. However, surveys of abortion clinics by the Guttmacher Institute found abortion rates considerably higher among poor youth as well, as are miscarriages. When the adult determinants of teenage sexual outcomes are considered, It is questionable whether teenage sex exists as a distinct behavior. Despite strenuous post-1975 efforts to reduce teenage childbearing, the birth rates among teens age 15 to 19 in 1999 versus the birth rate among adults ages 20 to 44 remains exactly the same ratio, 0.73, as it was in 1970 and 1950. So while the late 90s boom economy created more jobs and access to higher education that helped reduce birth rates among teens and adults to their lowest level in decades, no fundamental reforms have occurred that would prevent youthful birth rates from rising again when conditions worsen. Pointing out that family planning, sex education, and contraception provision are not solutions to teenage pregnancy and disease does not mean that they are useless. To the contrary, these services have been connected for nearly a century to enormous reductions in pregnancy, birth, and disease throughout the world. But they only work in conjunction with political reforms that improve the status of women, young people, and poorer populations. That is, by supplementing incentive to reduce births with the means to do so. But by claiming their programs can reduce or eliminate unwanted teenage sexual outcomes without the necessity of socioeconomic reform, liberal sex education and family planning advocates sabotage effective policy by letting politicians off the hook for their failure to address youth poverty. Myth number 4. messages and policies determine teen drug use. When I asked an assembly of 300 youth locked in Chicago's mammoth juvenile prison why so few kids are dying from drugs, only 7 of the city's 900 overdose deaths in 1999 were teens, several shouted, "Because you can't die from weed." Therein lies a powerful point both war on drugs officials and those who would reform drug policy are missing. Drug reformers like the Lynn Smith Center now insist that stopping teenage drug use should be the drug war's most urgent priority, and decriminalizing marijuana for adult pleasure, as the Netherlands does, is the best way to do it. Their logic is that American teens who now acquire marijuana and other drugs freely through unregulated illicit dealers would find drugs harder to get in illegal adults-only market regulated, like cigarettes and beer, to forbid underage use. Lynn Smith Center researcher Robert Sharp recently wrote columnist Ann Landers that the Netherlands' policy of legalizing marijuana with age controls has reduced overall drug use and protected children from drugs. Common Sense for Drug Policy sensibly argues for making drug treatment the top priority, but obtusely urges a tripling in spending to promote teenage abstinence. The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, NORML, states marijuana smoking is not for kids, but that it's time to stop arresting adults who smoke marijuana responsibly. Change the Climate advises parents that they can indulge their own pot pleasures while raising Just Say No kids. Drug reform groups showered accolades on the pro-drug war Drug Enforcement Administration-endorsed movie Traffic, largely because one young character absurdly said teenagers can get heroin easier than legal, regulated alcohol. Before their new Save the Children campaign, reformers used to argue that legal, government-regulated alcohol and tobacco were the big teenage drugs of choice. They were, and still are, right. Consistent surveys show American teens use illegal, age-regulated alcohol and tobacco 2.5 to 100 times more than illicit marijuana, ecstasy, or heroin. The 2000 Monitoring the Future survey shows that teens at every age find alcohol and tobacco far easier to obtain than every type of illicit drug, a pattern confirmed by use surveys. The Save the Children crusades of both drug warriors and the drug reformers distort Dutch and American drug realities. In fact, American drug reformers who raise popular fears of mild teenage drug experimentation in order to win legal highs for today's dangerous drug-abusing grown-up generation are pursuing tactics diametrically opposite to the Dutch strategy, which calms fear of youthful soft drug use to redirect attention to treating middle-aged hard drug addicts. Contrary to Lynn Smith's argument that protecting teenagers from their own drug use should be the primary mandate of drug policy, the Dutch enacted successful reforms precisely because they didn't panic over whether teenage marijuana use rose or fell. Conversely, American drug reform groups don't seem to perceive that drug warriors stymie reform by whipping up America's moralistic terror over whether a youth smokes a joint now and then. Those exercised over teenage pot smoking must be horrified at the increase after the Dutch decriminalized marijuana. The Netherlands Trimbos Research Institute found marijuana use in the previous month by Dutch 12 to 18-year-olds more than tripled from 3% in 1988 to 11% in 1996, then fell to 9% in 1999. American drug reform groups dodged that fact when they should be declaring, so what? Teenage marijuana use also soared in the 1990s in the United States and other prohibitionist countries, where zero tolerance ads, policies, arrests, imprisonments, and other punishments escalated. The U.S.'s National Household Survey on Drug Abuse found that 12 to 17-year-olds' monthly pot smoking rose from 5% in 1988 to 8% in 1996, where it remains in 1999. On the other side, drug warriors shamelessly demonized the Dutch experiment. The worst, but by no means the only distortion, was former drug czar Barry McCaffrey's fib that, quote, the murder rate in Holland is double that of the United States, and, quote, the overall crime rate in Holland is probably 40% higher than in the United States. That's drugs, unquote. As European media and political ridicule mounted, McCaffrey was forced to half-heartedly recant. U.S. murder rates are actually 8 times the Dutch rate, and the U.S. crime rate is well above the Netherlands. Today, Dutch teens use marijuana, heroin, cocaine, and ecstasy at about the same rate as U.S. teens. Dutch teens use legal alcohol and cigarettes at much higher rate, as they always have. Statistics on use don't matter, however. The important issue is that neither Dutch nor American teens show increasing appreciable drug use. In both countries in the 1990s, for example, teens under 20 comprised only about 3% of drug use deaths, with the vast bulk of drug use occurring among adults 35 and older. Ignoring small differences in trends, levels, and age groups surveyed, it's a wash. Neither libertarian Dutch legalization nor draconian U.S. prohibition has had any material effect on teenage drug proclivities. Obsession over messages drug policies send to teenagers reflects the exaggerated self-importance that drug war combatants attach to their irrelevant squabble over children and drugs. What the Dutch decriminalization and harm reduction reforms did achieve, in conjunction with comprehensive healthcare systems, is far more important. Dramatic reductions in drug abuse among older adults. Heroin deaths dropped from 40% there from the late 1970s to the late 1990s at the same time they were tripling in the U.S. Indeed, as the latest Dutch statistics show drug casualties falling, the newest U.S. Drug Abuse Warning Network reports show hospital emergency treatments and deaths involving drug overdoses soaring to their highest levels ever. From 1999 to 2000 alone, U.S. cocaine emergencies increased 4%, heroin emergencies rose 15%, and methamphetamine emergencies leapt 29%, all reaching record peaks. Today, Americans are dying from heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine at rates 7 times higher than the Dutch are. Both the appalling failure of America's war on drugs to stem drug abuse and the encouraging realities the Dutch experience uphold harm reduction reforms far more convincingly than the distorted claims about protecting children that reformers make. Teenagers are not waiting with bated bong for the latest official message or policy. Rather, teenagers' moderate patronage of soft drugs in Western nation appears to be a generally healthy reaction to the alarming damage they see hard drug abuse causing among adults around them. The Lynn Smith Center's excellent 1997 research compendium, Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts, thoroughly reviews hundreds of studies. Though there are individuals of all ages who can't handle drugs and others who reasonably choose abstinence, the research finding report no other reason why adults should be allowed to use marijuana responsibly that would not also apply to teens. Young age is not a valid criterion for discrimination. It is merely a politically convenient target. Final myth. Tougher controls produce better kids. Increasingly, over the last 25 years, panaceas have reigned. Teenage drinking? Raise the drinking age and ban it. School discipline? Impose zero tolerance in uniforms. Drugs? Zero tolerance and mass test kids. Youth crime? Curfews, adult trials, adult imprisonment, even execution. Initiated with increasing fervor during the 1990s, panaceas have three main features. They don't cost much. They do nothing to affect the larger values and conditions that powerfully affect youth behavior, and they never apply to the panacea's perpetrator. Youth curfews, school uniforms, student drug testing, zero tolerance, V-chips, music and movie labeling, internet censorship, youth firearms ban, charter education, and other cure-alls are widely popular with policymakers precisely because they don't disturb grown-up freedoms. But do they work? Consider the panacea acclaimed as the most effective. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration claims in its 1990 report that outlawing under 21 alcohol use saved 19,121 lives since 1975. The number is junk. The NHTSA multiplied 2.5-fold the small reduction in teenage traffic fatalities from an outdated Insurance Institute for Highway Safety study that used 1984 data. The study found that in states that raised drinking ages, traffic deaths fell 9% more among 18 to 20-year-olds than among drivers 21 to 24. But even the NHTSA number is embellished. Didn't the bulk research summarized in a general accounting office report find drinking age of 21 saved some lives? Yes, at first. However, more comprehensive long-term research reports more complex results. The 21 drinking age has a seesaw effect. Teen deaths go down a bit, but adult deaths rise. Rutgers and Baltimore University economists Peter Ash and David Levy, consultant for safety lobbies, reported that raising the drinking age to 21 slightly reduced fatal crashes by 18 to 20-year-old drivers at the expense of more deaths among 21 to 24-year-olds. The legal drinking age has no perceptible influence on fatalities, their exhaustive federally funded study concluded, but experience in drinking is an apparent risk factor independent of age. Their findings were confirmed in a 2001 paper by Swarthmore and University of Maryland economists Thomas D. and William Evans. Quote, the nationwide increase in MLDA, minimum legal drinking age, they have merely shifted some of the fatality risk from teens to young adults, unquote. They conclude after examining multiple factors. Raising drinking ages from 19 to 21 cut 18 and 19-year-old traffic deaths by 5%, but increased fatalities among 22 and 23-year-olds by 8%. The magnitude of mortality distribution, D. and Evans report, is quite large. These findings suggest that 21 drinking age doesn't save lives, it merely postpones deaths, perhaps even increases them. Why? Because, quote, learning by doing is an important component of teens' maturation, D. and Evans note. To the extent that age-based prohibition prevents adolescents from accomplishing their necessary tasks of practicing adult behaviors in adult settings, risks accumulate in more perilous young adult years where family and peer controls are weaker. Experimentation with adult behaviors is an essential part of adolescence that adults can guide or hamper, but not prevent. Recent panaceas, initially greeted with glowing political accolades, aren't even surviving the first round of research. Controlled studies of youth curfews in New Orleans, Cincinnati, Connecticut, New Jersey, and California cities find them either ineffective or contributory to higher crime rates. Large-scale reports by Notre Dame University and State Educational Testing Service researchers found school uniforms were not associated with improvements in student behaviors, attendance, or attitude, but they did accompany reduced academic achievement. ETS, that's the Educational Testing Service, also found schools' quote, zero tolerance policies ineffective at combating drug use or gangs. In short, the fear, myth-making, and repressive policies governing American attitudes towards youth are interfering with improvements that young people are making on their own. The question now is, how much more harm are institutions willing to inflict on adolescents in their futile crusade to abolish adolescence? The end.